members of the Institute and our friends tonight again. May I just repeat the commercial that I have on the board behind me and invite you all to become members of the Institute at your earliest convenience. I'm very pleased tonight to be able to introduce as our guest speaker Doris Anderson, who is editor of Chatelaine magazine. Doris was born in Calgary, so she's a Westerner, and she's a graduate in arts at the University of Alberta. But she tells me that she didn't really graduate in arts, but she was graduated in the Gateway newspaper, which is corresponds to the UBC magazine, UBC paper at UBC. And after university, she went to Toronto, where she's employed in various jobs, copy editing, radio script editing, writing, advertising, copywriting. She went to Europe, where she wrote fiction stories. Upon her return to Canada, she joined the staff of Chatelaine as a staff writer, and she's been there ever since, until she is now editor. She has also been married and is the mother of three sons. She is a past board chairman of the Metropolitan Toronto Children's Aid Society, a director of the Canadian Institute of Public Affairs, and she's at present the director of McLean Hunter Publishing and the Macmillan Publishing Company. She's a board member of the Canadian Film Development Corporation, and she's on the Board of Governors of York University and the Institute of Public Policy. She also holds an honorary LLD from the University of Alberta, and she's an officer of the Order of Canada. Doris Anderson is going to speak to us tonight on Canadianism in periodicals, films, and books. It gives me great pleasure to introduce to you Doris Anderson.
Thank you very much for that generous and flattering introduction. Whenever I hear all those things being rolled off, and I certainly don't do them all at one time, I understand to some extent why every once in a while I feel quite tired. The topic I'm going to speak on tonight is Canadianism in books, periodicals, and films. And I think I should begin by saying that, by assuring you really that this is not going to be a rabid nationalistic speech. And I'm a little embarrassed that I even have to say that in this country, in Canada. But I think I do, because it wasn't too long ago, about 2 years ago, I think, Walter Gordon, who was cabinet minister under the Pearson administration and certainly a nationalist, was being nominated as chancellor of York University, of which I'm on the board. And there was a big argument, seesawed back and forth, mostly from senators and faculty, that Walter Gordon was a dangerous person to become chancellor of a Canadian university because he might open his mouth and give a nationalist speech. And I found this incredible, that a chancellor of a university in a country like Italy, France, Sweden, the United States, or Texas would not be called a dangerous person for giving a nationalist speech in his own country. But in this country, that was considered a problem. But anyway, that problem was overcome, and Walter Gordon made a great chancellor. I think you've already heard that I'm a Westerner, and it's very kind of people in BC to call a person from Calgary a Westerner. I think I have an empathy with the West. I certainly feel that a great deal of whatever success I've had in the magazine business is due to the fact that I have a genuine feeling for this whole country. I compounded my sense of its immenseness by marrying a man from Prince Edward Island, so that I really feel I know Canada fairly well. When I grew up in Calgary, those were the days of solid social credit and CCF, and even the odd communist was around. And I had to go all the way to Toronto after I'd graduated from university before I met. And I really was astonished. A real, true, blue conservative. At the same time, it was almost as big a shock to me to meet a WASP coming from the West, which is multicultural. A WASP was a nasty insect that stung you. And I never dreamed that it referred to a person, and that some people might even boast about being one. Anyway, tonight I'm talking about books, periodicals, and films in Canada. And I want to say that I'm not going to be talking about Canadian culture, which is quite a different thing. I think Robert Fulford put it just about as well as anybody could put it. Certainly for my generation. He said, "We grew up believing that if you were very good or if you were very smart, you'd gradually graduate from Canada." That was our attitude towards Canadian culture. Canadian culture today is fairly well supported. Something like $27 million a year goes into supporting symphonies, plays, operas, Stratford, the Shaw Festival, etc. Only a very small proportion of that goes into original Canadian works. And so I'm not going to touch that tonight, and I'm not going to talk about repatriating our natural resources and our industries. I'll leave that to the FIRA, Walter Gordon, and the Toronto Star. I'm going to talk about popular culture, the culture of the people, and why it's so important to preserve what we have and to put in place the legislation to protect what I think is endangered. And rather than start with periodicals, I'll start with something I know even less about, which is books. Canadians are not a book-buying people. For many years, the Canada Publishing Companies were mostly in Eastern Canada, and they were rather comfortable.
Pardon me, I'm sorry, but I don't think you can hear you too well. It's my fault. Would you put this on? I think this is...
Oh, well, maybe I can just raise it.
No, put this on. I think it might be better.
Okay.
Sorry.
It's like spinning a web. I don't think anyone can hear me yet. Can you hear me? Well, maybe I'll just hold it. Is that better? I don't think you missed very much anyway. I start out with books. I'm on the board of Macmillan Publishing Company, and for a long time, book publishing companies were, as you probably know, mainly located in Eastern Canada, and book publishers were comfortable, modestly scholarly, and they lived a fairly easygoing life. They weren't too aggressive. I used to have an awful time getting books out of Canadian book publishers to excerpt for magazines. They seemed to think that if they let 3,000 words out of a book, that people wouldn't buy the book. I was being deluged at the same time with all kinds of books from New York. And the people in New York obviously had another concept of promotion. So that I thought the Canadian book publishers were just a bit slow. But they were cautious. And their main source of income was from textbooks for schools. And as a pupil in the Alberta schools, the names Ryerson, Clark Irwin, Macmillan, Gage, McClellan, and Stewart were all very familiar to me. I even became acquainted with the streets on which those companies operated. And later on, it was no surprise to me to find that there was a street called Bloor and a street called Young and even a street called Spadina. Those books, those textbooks that we studied in school were crammed full of British history, all very much to the credit of the Britons, British poetry and literature, and some mostly light Canadian literature, Leacock, Robert W. Service, and a little poetry, Bliss Carman, and the song My Paddle Sings, etc., etc. There's very little U.S. literature included in those books. With the money that these people made from their textbooks, the Canadian companies were able to publish novels and scholarly works on which they generally lost money, but they survived. There were U.S. firms in Canada, such as McGraw-Hill, Doubleday, but they were mostly distributing agents. And quite often, U.S. companies didn't even bother doing that. They dealt through Canadian firms to distribute U.S. books in Canada. Then came the 1960s, and all of this changed. We were into the age of learning materials. Kids were going to learn from machines. Things were going to be flashed up on boards, and if the child got it right, they got a Tootsie Roll, and if they got it wrong, they got a slap across the knuckles. And of course, this didn't work, but a lot of schools went into learning materials hardware, and most of this came from the United States. At the same time, school boards were given a great deal more freedom. They didn't have to buy prescribed texts from Canadian companies. They could shop around. And many of these boards went directly to U.S. firms, not even through Canadian agents. And the Americans, as usual, were quite aggressive. They would sometimes fly school boards right down to their main office, wine and dine them, and with good Canadian taxpayers' money, every cent of what went into that particular district's school textbooks and libraries was spent directly into the United States. Ah, the school boards had a pretty good argument. They said that they could buy the books cheaper. And of course they could buy them cheaper. They were being produced in a mass way. But we don't buy that argument in this country for such things as fabrics, automobiles, oil, or wheat. So I don't see why we should buy it for textbooks either. Last summer, the Association of Canadian Publishers did a study on this situation. And I think the findings were pretty damning and pretty startling for anybody who's concerned about education in this country and the future of the publishing industry. 57.6% of sales in Canada are for textbooks, and that's the most profitable by far part of the publishing industry. Canadian-owned firms make about a third of those sales. And foreign firms, mostly U.S. firms, get two-thirds of those sales. Yet, in the other part of publishing, which is the original publishing of new novels, of new or established authors, the Canadians bring out three times as many books as the U.S. firms. And we're being a little bit generous here, too, because many of these school books that are sold by U.S. outlets in Canada are really adaptations of U.S. texts. And it's certainly very clear that if more of the money that goes into Canadian textbooks to be studied in Canadian schools by Canadian children could go to Canadian firms, it would go a long way to solving some of our problems in the book industry. I'd just like to state another fact or two about Canadian publishing in Canada. In Canadian-owned bookstores, Canadian books do quite well, to the tune of about 20% of the sales. In big chains or foreign-owned bookstores, Canadian books do much less well. Instead of 20% of the sales, 2% of the sales. The paperback business in Canada, with the exception of Harlequin romances, is almost entirely owned by foreign ownership, and 96% of the sales in Canada of paperbacks are for foreign-owned paperbacks. In the book clubs, we don't do very well either. We only have one Canadian book club, and I was once a judge on it, Readers Club of Canada. It was always on the brink of bankruptcy. We never got paid for our reviews. We had a great time, and I think it's doing a little better now, but even the book clubs that do very well in Canada only choose Canadian books 7% of the time. All of this has a rather devastating effect on the knowledge Canadians have of themselves. I don't know whether you're familiar with Mel Hertig's study among 1,000 graduating high school students in 1975, but I'm not so sure that the general population would do very well on these kinds of questions either. But fewer than 30% of graduating high school students knew that the BNA Act was Canada's constitution. 21% couldn't name Ottawa as the capital of Canada. 61% couldn't name a single Canadian writer. Some of them thought John Diefenbaker was a U.S. senator, and that the Imperial Oil Company was a Canadian company. In some provinces, there are no Canadian literature courses taught at all. And in some parts of Canada, there are fewer than a dozen Canadian books on our reading lists for high school students. Well, I think there's a great concern. There's been a backlash, which is almost as frightening as some of the things that happened in the 60s about education. And there's a great concern we all have about what's happening in our schools. And I think what happened was the schools tried and are trying to educate all of the children of all of the people, which is perfectly legitimate. I remember my grade one class. There were 8 rows of children, and there was a row over by the window that, to my horror when I think back on it, we called the dummies. And the teacher paid no attention to those children. I don't know what their learning problems were. I think some of them couldn't see the board. I think some of them didn't have enough for breakfast. I think some of them were sleepy. But nobody bothered to find out what their problems were. They just weren't keeping up with the rest of the class. They were eventually shunted off into what was called an opportunity class, laughingly. And they were, no one tried to salvage them. And I think today we're doing a lot better on with children like that. But we're also very much concerned with what's coming out at the other end, because we find kids coming out of high school that can't write essays, that can't spell. Universities are having to put in what is called bonehead English classes and freshman classes to try and bring students up to standard. I get very disturbed as a parent of 3 children when I'm told that by teachers that really what they're only trying to accomplish in school today is functional English. What does functional English mean? Does that mean being able to read the brand labels that you've seen on the television screen, also in the supermarket? Does that mean being able to follow the directions on a TV dinner wrapper? Went over to talk to the principal of the school one day about one son who was having trouble with math, and the principal said to me very blandly, "Oh, don't worry about that. Computers are coming in all the time, and all he needs to do is learn how to run a computer." Well, then I started to talk to him about another son who wasn't doing very well in spelling. And his answer to that one disturbed me even more. He said, "Well, he's a very aggressive, he's a people person. So he's obviously going to have a secretary and she will do the spelling." And as a feminist, that answer really disturbed me. Why should my son, who hasn't taken the trouble to learn how to spell, automatically be the boss of a bright girl who has gone to all the trouble to be first class in English? So that kind of answer, and that's a true answer, really does disturb me. I've also had arguments with teachers who couldn't see why I objected to textbooks in math, where all the references were to U.S. locations. I don't live in Los Angeles. I'm awfully well aware of it in the middle of January. And I think my children are already deluged with all kinds of misinformation about the U.S. way of life on television. And I think in Canadian schools, our children should be getting a firm underpinning of knowledge, of awareness of this country. I'm glad to see that British Columbia has announced that it's going to have a core curriculum, and Ontario has also announced this. I have 2 children in high school. I don't think I'm I can't even think of the word. I think I'm quite forward-looking, but I am concerned about children dribbling their way through high school, taking a typing course here and a little social studies there and a little gym here and maybe art there, and at the end of it coming out with a high school degree that's absolutely worthless for any other future training. And I think a core curriculum is a very good idea. To return briefly to publishing, the federal government has made several attempts, and I think should be applauded for them, to help writers in Canada. Certainly Canada Council grants and Canada Days, which are sponsored by various arts council, provincial arts council and federal arts councils, keep some writers alive. When I graduated from university, I had the wonderful idea that I really would like to become a fiction writer. I never wanted to become an editor. I sort of stumbled into that. But there was no possible way you could support yourself as a fiction writer in those days. And I'm glad to say today, by living pretty frugally, you can. And I know some that are, and I think this latest move of, and it's certainly no grand sum, but it's a sum a person can live on, that the Canada Council is awarding $16,000 to three writers in 1977 just to support them so that they can write a book. Well, let's turn now to periodicals. People think periodicals, magazines, are rather frivolous. I don't think they are. I've never considered them frivolous at all. I think they are influential. I like to quote Edgar Allan Poe, who said that magazines are the light artillery of the mind. I think one of the best things you can say about periodicals is that they try at least to be national in scope rather than regional or city-based. And in a country like Canada that says as wide and big and stretched as narrow as it is across that long, long border, with that Niagara Falls of information and influence coming across the border in the same language, in the same kind of lifestyle, I think periodicals are as essential as the railway was in 1867, as it was to establish the CBC in the 1930s. I think without a periodical press, we're really not a country. And believe it or not, the periodical press was once a flourishing press in Canada. Magazines are always, to some extent, a precarious kind of business. They always have a high death rate. But the nice thing about them is for every one that dies, a new one appears. I've made a hobby of collecting old magazines, and my front hall is covered in them, and about two-thirds of them were once magazines that were household words, and nobody has heard of them for 40 or 50 years now. Being in the magazine business under those conditions, I think has been highly stimulating and dangerous. And that's probably why I like it. Being in the magazine business in Canada has almost been suicidal. Magazines have two functions. One is to inform, and the second is to entertain. I think we inform better than we entertain. I think that television certainly has taken over the entertainment business a little for magazines. I think today people turn to magazines mainly for ideas. Magazines have always copied one another. A good new idea in magazines is always imitated. Newsweek came as a result of Time. After Playboy made its success, there was a whole spate of magazines that copied it, so that Playboy almost looks like a rather saintly, staid magazine today compared to some of the other magazines on the newsstand. Magazines must constantly change in their format, their typography, and their content, or they rapidly find themselves out of date. I love it when some young 22, 23-year-old girl comes up to me and says, "You know, I used to pick up Chatelaine when I lived at home with my mother. My mother always got magazines. She was a kind of a nationalist. And I used to think it was a pretty dull magazine in those days." And by 1970, the news magazines were beginning to talk about it. And then the newspapers got excited about it. Another example is breast cancer. The women's magazines were onto that very early. The women's movement is another example. And Pat Carbine, the editor of Ms. Magazine, who was then associate editor of Look, gets the credit for running the first story on the women's movement. And that was in the late, I think that was close to 1970. And that really burns me, because Chatelaine had been writing about the women's movement long before Betty Friedan wrote her book in 1962. But of course, Americans don't read Canadian magazines. Styles of journalism change. I'm glad we're beginning to get out of the personal journalism. I'm a little disturbed right now when I talk to students in journalism, and they all want to grow up to look exactly like Robert Redford and get the goods on a president or a senator or at least a city councillor. I think it will be good when we work our way out of that one too. We've always had in Canada, as long as I've been in the business, a tough time in magazines. We still do. 98% of the magazines sold on any newsstand in Canada are foreign publications. In the 1930s, two of the most powerful magazines in the world, Time and Reader's Digest, came into Canada, and they stripped out their advertising, using the same editorial material that had already been paid for and came into the Canadian edition absolutely free. They added, in Time's case, three or four pages of Canadian material, called themselves a Canadian magazine, and competed with native periodicals for advertising. There's no other country in the world that was naive enough to let that happen to its periodical press. The R.B. Bennett government of the 1930s brought in very stiff legislation to stop this. And immediately, there was a fresh response in Canadian publishing. A lot of new magazines were started. Then the Liberals got in. The whole thing became a political football, and they repealed the legislation. In the 1940s and 50s, Canadian magazines dropped off at an alarming rate. There were more magazines dying than there were new magazines beginning, and that is a very bad thing. I'll just name a few of them. The Canadian National, Canadian Home Journal, which was a Canadian woman's magazine that was started much earlier than Chatelaine. Mayfair, Canadian Homes and Gardens. New World, which was a picture magazine like Look and Life. In the 1950s, another attempt was made to bring in legislation to relieve Time and Reader's Digest of their special privileges. And the conservatives got in then. The history of the magazine industry seems to be all tied up with these strange changes of government. And because that was liberal legislation, they threw it out. But they did set up the O'Leary Commission. And the O'Leary Commission brought in a report that was very strongly for Time and Reader's Digest to lose these special privileges. But then the Liberals came in again. But at that time, Walter Gordon was firmly convinced that this was good legislation, and he was all ready to pass it. And this is documented in his book. When Henry Luce of Time magazine put pressure on Washington, and Washington put pressure on Ottawa that they would not sign the Ottawa Pact if they went through with this legislation, so the legislation was not passed. Instead, they passed legislation to keep Time and Reader's Digest in Canada, but no other magazines could come in. And this was a typical Canadian compromise, because at that time, McCall's, Newsweek, and several business publications had plans on the books to move into Canada and get in on part of this bonanza. And believe me, if McCall's had come into Canada, included a couple of Canadian stories. At that time, McCall's was a very thick, glossy magazine with about 64 pages of four color. And included a couple of Canadian stories and competed with Chatelaine for advertising. There would be no Chatelaine today. And the simplistic argument that all you have to do is be great and you can beat anybody is really simplistic. It's like telling somebody, you're going to be in a race, and you're so great, we're going to start you at 100 yards, and we're going to give your competitor a 90-yard advantage over you, but you can still win, because I know you're good. That just doesn't work. In 1970, the Keith Davey Commission, which was a senator, Keith Davey was a senator, and this was conducted from the Senate, held another commission, and again said that Time and Reader's Digest should lose these special privileges. And finally, very quietly, this fall, Bill C-58 was passed after a long, bitter, loud harangue that went on for 2 years. The bill simply says that a publication in Canada to be called a Canadian publication has to be 75% Canadian owned and 80% substantially different in content. Personally, I think that's still an advantage for a foreign magazine. If I got one-fifth of what I put in Chatelaine free, I would consider that an advantage. Time very arrogantly folded its editorial offices, absorbed the tax for its advertisers, which gives you some idea of how much money they must have been making, and is doubled its subscription price and is carrying on. Reader's Digest, having made a great fuss that they couldn't possibly meet either of these conditions. They have now decided they will meet those conditions, and they're here. Since the legislation was passed, there's been a spate of new magazines, mostly giveaway magazines, which I don't really consider legitimate magazines, but I think the opportunity is there. And as the editor of one of the few Canadian magazines that has survived, and not only survived, but made money most of the time, I think that we now have the opportunity for a strong periodical press in Canada. Not only for a national press, but for regional periodical magazines. And whether we meet that challenge is up to us. I certainly know that we have enough talent in writing, editors, photographers, illustrators, to do the job. I have no doubt about that at all. And now I'd like to talk briefly about films. Again, very early on, there were lots of people in Canada who made very innovative attempts to start a Canadian film industry. And this is documented better than I could ever do it in Pierre Burton's book, Hollywood in Canada. One of the biggest problems that these people had was the same problem that we have today, and that's getting the film shown, because the distributing companies in Canada were mostly US-owned. And finally, they pretty well gave up. And Canadians saw themselves portrayed in movies, which were made in the United States, but I don't think any legitimate Canadian would ever recognize Canada by all those snowy fir trees and those sex-mad French-Canadian trappers. And even the Mountie uniforms were jazzed up because Sam Goldwyn didn't think they were flashy enough. Today, Canada is still the most profitable area for the sale of U.S. films. And in a film festival held 2 weeks ago in Canada, in Toronto, we got films from all over the place, from Italy, from Sweden, from Czechoslovakia, from Spain. The one country we couldn't get any films from was the United States. And the United States wouldn't send any films to this film festival because Canada was just considered an extended part of the U.S. territory. And So that pretty well told us where we stood with them. The Canadian Film Development Corporation was set up in 1967, and it was to support and help the private sector in filmmaking, which is quite a different thing from what the National Film Board has been doing since the 1930s. The National Film Board has been making documentaries for screening inside Canada and outside Canada to tell people about Canada. The Canadian Film Development Corporation is to help the private filmmaking industry make commercial films. This could have been done many, many years before, because we have the actors. We did have the CBC, which produced many actors who had to go to the US or Britain to get into film work. We could have had a flourishing film industry, such as countries like Sweden, Czechoslovakia, Italy, and France developed. But those countries not only supported national films, but they put quotas or taxes on tickets at the box office, so that some of the revenue from foreign films flowed back into the native industry. If we had done that, today some $180 million goes straight back into the United States from box offices, ticket sales in Canada. And if we only had a small proportion of that, that would make quite a difference to filmmaking in this country. Because the Canadian Film Development Corporation has a maximum of about $5 million a year. And that could be all gobbled up with one medium big Hollywood production. But since 1967, the Canadian Film Development Corporation has put money into 120 Canadian films, most of which you've never heard of and you certainly have never seen. About 20 of them have returned money on the investment. And some of those you will recognize. Duddy Kravitz was one of them. Lies My Father Told Me is another. Black Christmas is another. Shivers is another. You may not agree with those last two that I mentioned, but at least it proves if junk is what the public want to see, why not make our own junk? Especially if we can make money on it. Again, the big problem is not making good films so much. That's a problem enough. And it's a problem in Hollywood and Rome and France, everywhere. Who knows what's going to really go over and what's not. But one of the additional problems in Canada is getting those films into these theaters, because the two big theater chains are owned by Odeon and Famous Players. And both of those chains entered into a voluntary quota with Hugh Faulkner, who was then the Secretary of State, in the summer of 1975, to show a minimum of 4 weeks of Canadian films in theaters across Canada. The only trouble with that is they've lived up to that agreement in big cities. But it still doesn't work very well. A rather sensitive film with almost no promotion is flung into the Imperial Six in Toronto, and it's maybe there for a couple of weeks and then it's gone. And it's only very keen moviegoers that will be watching for it and go to see it. So although they're living up to the agreement, it still isn't working very well. Several provincial governments, including the BC government, have made noises from time to time that they're going to impose quotas on films shown in theaters in BC, or they're going to put in a tax. Personally, I think a tax is the way to go. Get some of that money back and get it back into Canadian filmmaking. Quotas are an awkward and difficult thing to manage, and as we've seen, often don't work. Well, we're just on the brink of pay television, and this seems to me like a last crack at doing it right, and doing it right from the beginning. And I hope, instead of sliding into a situation where our cable companies, and we're the most wired country in the world, Canada is, we have many more cable companies in Canada than we do than for example, the United States. Pay TV must not become a vehicle where cable companies buy first-run Hollywood features and the odd sports event, and all the money goes to the cable companies, Hollywood, and a football team in the United States. I have no clear-cut solution for pay television, but I've given you enough cautionary tales tonight of what can happen if we don't put some legislation in place about pay TV at the right time. And I think we should do it right, and we should do it cautiously so that some of that money goes back into Canadian production. Well, I'm coming to the end of my speech, and I really can't, as the editor of a woman's magazine, end everything up without making some comment about women and men. There's been lots of talk over the last 5 years about legislation that will help women in Canada, and there have been pounds and pounds of recommendations ground out by various councils of women in provinces and federally. There's been thousands of hours of talk and very little solid legislation. No program of affirmative action and no ERA proposals in sight. However, the encouraging part of the whole picture is I don't think there's a woman alive in Canada today who is exactly the same as she was 5 years ago. I think that the women's movement has thoroughly penetrated Canadian society. And it's done it in strange, funny ways. One of them was the Irene Murdoch case in Alberta, the ranch wife who was kicked off the ranch with a jaw broken in two places. And when she brought her case before the courts, the judge told her, 25 years of work beside your husband branding steers and dehorning bulls and running a house and raising the kids is only what a wife should do. And that, and he awarded her $200 a month. And that really jarred women. Really realized how little rights they had before the courts. And since then, the BC government, the Ontario government, and the federal government, who all had been engaged in commissions and in looking into reform of family law, have come forth with some tentative proposals for changing the law. And it looks as though something might finally be done. Women today are much more aware of the possibilities of their rights. Or they're either scared stiff. They've embraced the total woman idea. And they're popping out from behind the kitchen door at night dressed in a bunny suit to surprise their husband. jerk his jaded libido into some kind of action. Frankly, I think that probably all they're going to do is give him a heart attack. Many, many women are taking their place in business, in government, and the professions. And I really like some of the anecdotes that are coming out. There was a young woman elected to the House of Representatives in the United States, and she was the mother of two young children, and some kindly old man man who'd been in the House of Representatives for many years came up to her and said, "And what is a pretty young thing like you with two little kitties at home doing in a place like this?" And she replied very pertly to him, "Well, I have a brain and I have a uterus and I'm using both of them." And I like even better the story of Bella Arsbug's husband, when somebody was trying to nail him on a television program by saying, "What keeps your marriage together?" And he looked the interviewer straight in the eye and he said, "Sex." I also think that statements like, I think people who have no idea they're helping the women's movement have helped the women's movement a great deal. And one person I'd like to thank tonight from the bottom of my heart is W. Earl McLaughlin. President of the Royal Bank, who came out flat-footedly and said he couldn't find in the whole of Canada a woman with the capabilities to serve in the board of the Royal Bank. Well, Bob McIntosh, who's the vice president of the Bank of Nova Scotia, and I know Bob McIntosh quite well, was a little more adroit than that. He said that they were looking very hard for a woman, but one of the big problems is that a woman, according to their bank act, had to come up with $100,000 worth of stock. Well, I didn't buy any of that. The business and professional women supplied both those banks with a long list of women, capable women, who'd been running businesses, who certainly had $100,000. And we all know that that's no big problem anyway. Banks can arrange loans to be paid back quite slowly at prime rate or something less than prime rate if they want somebody on their board. That's not really a big problem. However, W. Earl McLaughlin certainly didn't know what he was, how far he was sticking his foot in his mouth, because a lot of women simply wrote to him and said, "I don't like your attitude, and I'm taking my business to a bank with a different attitude." And so within a couple of months, both of those banks have found women directors. And no matter how much help W. Earl McLaughlin has been to the women's movement, although I'm sure he didn't know he was being as helpful, it's not surprising that there are a few people around with attitudes like that, because only 100 years ago, women were regarded as in the same category as idiots and children. They had absolutely no rights at all over money, their own bodies, over their own children. And they legally died when they got married. They became their husband's property completely. And it was just 50 years ago when women were, when we were rubbing lemon on chairs to give it a shine. This was long before all those wonderful TV commercials with those idiot women running around being so ecstatic about the shine that they're getting on their floors and their furniture. And long before those Alka-Seltzer commercials, which I think are some of the most imaginative television that we ever see, there was another cure for a headache, which I discovered years ago and an old black almanac that my pioneering grandmother lugged out to Calgary in those early days. And I was quite surprised to read it because it said, to cure a headache, take half a cup of gin before breakfast. And that wasn't the kind of household that I grew up in, where gin was ever even mentioned, let alone women taking it before breakfast. Today, I think perhaps it might be a good idea if the men took the gin before breakfast to cope with today's woman, because women have changed very rapidly. And although we've magazines and men and doctors have been very concerned over all kinds of things that are happening to women physically, about estrogen counts and cancer and our sexual appetite and everything else, there's a great undiscovered continent of what's going on in women's minds. And I think that the dialogue is just beginning. Well, what has all this to do with periodicals, films, and books? Just this, that we're living in very serious times and rather disturbing times. Sometimes, for the first time since Confederation, we really feel that this nation is in danger of falling apart, that it may not stick together. And I'm not suggesting that women have any bright, new, original answers, but at least I think it's a step in the right direction if we use more effectively all the talents and all the abilities of all of the people. And we certainly haven't been doing that in the past. We've been educating women exactly the same as boys, and then not using that training. And that's a disadvantage compared to most Western nations and nations like Japan that are using women better. We really need to find workable solutions to these perplexing inherited problems that we're beginning to face up to. So it's a time to be innovative, not imitative. A time to depend and build on our regional and cultural differences and experiences, and to be proud of them and respect them. And from these strengths only can we hope to achieve a confident stance and contribute in the way a great and fortunately nation like Canada should in the affairs of the world. I think I could have chosen quite a different and a much more catchy title for this talk tonight, and it simply would have been, Who's Afraid of Canadian Culture? Only Canadians themselves. Thank you.
I understand you'd like to have any written line answering a few questions.
Thanks.
The speaker,
I've explained to our speaker that she's to expect a flood of questions from male chauvinists in the audience, and she said she's prepared to meet them. May I just say, speaking as a male chauvinistic judge, that as to use the word she has used herself, that there is a simplistic attitude to the Murdoch case, which has perhaps not been entirely explained tonight. Are there some questions to be placed to this lady?
Yes, sir.
It's a girl servant here. I wonder if all this also applies to Clark. A magazine, a national magazine such as Kathleen, fair with those who read French only, and in general, how do other old magazines deal with that problem or open?
Well, we deal with it very well. We've been printing a French edition since 1962. It's not exactly the same as the English edition, but we have a very cooperative exchange of articles, artwork, photography between the two editions, and we get along very well. There's a funny story in connection with that. In 1928, when Chatelaine was started, there was a national competition to name it, and a woman in Langley, B.C. won with the name Chatelaine. Well, by the time I got to Chatelaine, everyone thought the name Chatelaine was a big drag. You know, nobody understood what a Chatelaine was, and, you know, it was a terrible detriment. Well, it so happened when we started the French edition in 1962, it was a terrific bonus because all we had to do was put a little accent over the A and we were in business.
Yes?
Would you repeat that?
Yes. The question was, do I have a prototype of a reader in mind, and what sort of a person is she? And I get a lot of feedback from readers in letters, and when I go out speaking. And all the editors do quite a lot of speaking, and we all get quite a lot of mail. And we get a lot more mail when we publish something readers don't like, and than when we publish things they do like. I think my job would be a great deal easier if I didn't have to appeal or try to appeal to all Canadian women. But since Chatelaine is virtually the only Canadian women's magazine, I really think I have to try to appeal to all Canadian women. That's why I think we get so much criticism that we run the spectrum from the home, you know, the crocheted Afghan right up to the quite radical feminist article. And I don't know. I think what we've got going for us most of all is that we are Canadian. As Canadian as a maple leaf from cover to cover. I don't know whether I've answered your question or not.
Mentioned how the standard of English is being used in the schools is deteriorating. Does this mean that in time to come, the language you will use in periodicals will be more juvenile, less good English than it is now because of this change in the standard of English?
No, I don't think so. I think the style of writing has changed. When I started out in journalism, it was almost a deadly sin to use the first person pronoun. You never took a first-person point of view. And now personal journalism is very much in vogue. And to some extent, I think that's a good thing. I think if we're going to read a story by June Callwood about, say, Judy LaMarche, it's why shouldn't we know whether June Callwood hates, likes, what reaction she herself has to the personality she's writing about? And in the old style of writing, we always took the attitude that this was some objective godlike creature giving the final word on this person that was being written about. And it was quite often quite a prejudiced point of view, but wasn't presented that way. I can't see any deterioration in writing in periodicals. I think we write a little looser and a little with a little more racy and colorful language, but I don't think that we're trying to write down to the public. I hope not. Yes, this man here.
Mrs. Addison, I may have interpreted your remarks wrong, but it seems to me that what you are advocating in general is massive government support and legislation to support periodicals and books and other forms of media for Canadian publishers and Canadian authors. I'm a Canadian author, and personally I revolt very much against this idea. I say if you're not prepared to support me as a writer, then I shouldn't be writing.
Well, I've obviously wasted my time for the last hour. Because that isn't what I was saying at all. I was saying that so much of the legitimate money that should be going into publishing houses in textbook, to support the textbooks, which is going into Canadian schools, and it's taxpayers' money that's being used. That was the underpinning of most book publishing houses in Canada, which allowed them then to support novelists and authors. And I think that we should make a swing back in that direction so that more of that money is going back into book publishing in Canada. The book publishers are standing with their backs to the wall because that support has been removed from them. And so many of them have been bought out or have been threatened to be bought out by U.S. interests. Yes?
Is there an awareness in the magazine industry as to the psychology of even right-hand margin? How dull a column looks when it's even on both the right and left, great numbers of hyphenated words.
I'm not sure I understand what you.
Well, now you put stuff together with a compensator so that you get an even right-hand margin as well as a right as a left-hand margin. Psychologically, it's quite dull. Is there any reaction?
Oh well. I don't know. You should talk to my art director. Art directors think it looks beautiful. And the more gray and the more dull it looks, the more beautiful they think it is. And we're always being asked to fill in lines so it'll look even duller and more even. And this is an argument that goes on forever. Frankly, I think an awful lot of I think the compensator is a good thing. It's faster, it's quicker. We're a long way from reporters or writers sitting in front of a typewriter and typing on a TV screen, and it, you know, it's sent off and immediately goes into either photocopy or lead, or we've been talking about electronic typesetting for 20 years, and I'm still waiting for it to happen. It's like a lot of other things we talk about, but that compensator I really like. I think it saves time. Okay, yes?
Have you any ideas, any suggestions how CBC television could be a unifying force the way CBC radio used to be for Canada?
Could you repeat that?
Yes, the question was, have I any idea how CBC television could be a unifying force the way CBC radio used to be? And I think really the CBC does quite a good job. I think the Fifth Estate is one of the best investigative journalism programs that we've seen in many a long time. The problem simply is that there's just too many demands on everyone's time. You know, there's, when we all used to listen to Andrew Allen's series on Sunday night, there was no television, there weren't 13 channels of other stations to look at, there wasn't nearly as many magazines, there weren't all the other things that people can do now, tape recorders, yoga lessons, goodness knows what. And I really think the CBC still does a pretty good job. Many programs. Yes?
You mentioned earlier that Canadians were not a book-buying people. It seems to me that one of the reasons is that the costs of books have been increasing. I want to understand inflationary factors involved. At the same time, it seems to me that the quality of the book, that is the paper, the quality and so forth, could be reduced in the same way, for example, if you do in Europe. If you don't have a glossy paper and the very fancy cover and so forth, could not the cost be reduced and perhaps increase the distribution?
Well, I think you're absolutely right. The pocketbook industry never really got off the ground here, and that's a pity, because that's one way books could be much cheaper. But the pocketbook industry, again, is pretty well controlled by foreign outlets, British and U.S., As I mentioned before, the number of pocketbooks sold in Canada is a very tiny number. I don't know why we're so hesitant about buying books when you have to pay $3.50 to go to a movie and you can't get into a play really now. I don't know what... I often pay as high as $10 for a seat for a very mediocre one-night performance of a play. I don't know why we balk at putting out that same amount of money for a book. Just feel that we're a nation that has not been used to spending that kind of money on books. And it's a pity.
How good are you about getting new Canadian writers into your magazine? Used to be possible. I walked in on you and started selling you stories, which is some time ago. And I hear a lot of young people say we couldn't possibly get into Chatelaine because, you know, it's just too far above us. Have you got any policy about new writers?
Oh dear. That's the question was, how do you break into Chatelaine? And by an old friend who's sold quite a number of articles to Chatelaine. The answer is just by having a good idea and some talent and probably a little persistence. We're desperate for good writers, especially fiction writers. I'll just give you an example. We got an article in several years ago about daycare. And I don't know how many times we've done articles on daycare, and this article didn't say anything particularly original, but it was well written. So I phoned the writer up and said, I don't want to buy this article, but I'd like to see you. And she came in to see me, and we talked, and we decided that she should try an article on how women were fluffing off on jury duty, which was an idea we both agreed on. And she went off and wrote the article and sold it to us and became, over the next 2 years, one of our chief contributors. And she continued to be a chief contributor until somebody in television discovered her. And her name was Barbara Frum. All she had was talent and an idea. It's not that hard to break in. Yes?
Ms. Anderson, I wonder if you would tell us about the Trilateral Commission and what attracted you to it. And are you going to be able to stop all those men in that men's world from their war games?
Oh. I don't think the Trilateral Commission has got any plans to start a war that I know of. The Trilateral Commission was started by David Rockefeller of the Chase Manhattan Bank, brother of Nelson Rockefeller, former governor and former vice president of the United States, with the idea that communications between Britain and the United States had broken down and that the Japanese had never been adequately brought into these discussions. So that the Trilateral Commission was set up with Rockefeller money, with 60 Europeans, 60 North Americans, of which 8 were Canadians, and 60 Japanese. And Brzezinski, who is one of the chief candidates now as possibly to replace Kissinger if in the Carter government, was the secretary. He was very energetic. A lot of papers were turned out from various people around the world on with suggested solutions to economic problems, suggested solutions for better cooperation between Europe and the United States and Japan. It was like taking a PhD course for me, and certainly the whole idea and thrust of the Trilateral Commission has been to solve problems, not start wars.
But it's the same men who are involved in the nuclear buildup and the persistence of the Cold War. We look for a change in a less elitist approach to world affairs. And here is a segregated group of people who are not part of the common citizen, to use a bad word, arranging our affairs for us. I don't understand why we're attracted to it.
Well, it's a bit like the Club of Rome. You know, the attitude was set up some study groups, get some of the best brains in the world thinking about these problems, and I personally don't see it as a sinister thing at all. Yes.
Probably because you were treating it as a substitute for a PhD. If you'd taken a PhD, you'd know better than to have joined the Trilateral Commission. Mr. Chairman, I wanted to ask Doris to say a little bit more about the problem of the periodical in French calendar. Now, I know that wasn't the main burden of your address tonight, but I was very interested that when you commented that had the legislation finally not been passed that removed the privileges from time, that McCall's could very well have, with a few additional pages, taken over market that Châtelain now has. It crossed my mind to wonder whether Châtelain had had the same problem from any a French newspaper, a periodical from France. In other words, beginning about 1962, where French periodicals in Quebec, Canadian periodicals, having the same kind of threats coming to them from periodicals in France, and similarly, to what extent do you feel the French-Canadian publishing industry has been seriously undermined, particularly in the textbook part of its operations, by French publishers, as has the English-Canadian industry by American publishers? And in other words, I'm asking if you would mind giving us just a little bit of a comparison between the two.
Mm-hmm. Well, I hope everyone heard the question. Dr. Jewett has asked me to give a quick rundown of books, films, and periodicals in Quebec, and whether they were threatened by an invasion of French periodicals, books, and films. And I'm really not competent to say that about books. I don't know. I simply don't know. The periodicals in French Canada, some of them have died off, and some of them have been absorbed in others. I don't think any great threat ever came from France. As a matter of fact, it's difficult to get Marie Claire and Elle, you know, to even send the magazines to Canada anytime within 6 weeks of their publication. They seem to be totally unaware of that market over there, although I think they sell quite well in Quebec. I don't think any attempt has been made to do the same thing in periodicals. In film and television, I don't think it's any secret that having a different language has been a great advantage in Quebec. The television has flourished with its own stars. The French films have had quite a success, and most of the time, at least 20% of the films being shown in Quebec are Canadian-made films. And the advantage, of course, is having a separate language. I don't.
Does Chatelaine itself have any trouble?
Chatelaine is not a big money maker, but it's had a it's got a steady, loyal audience, and I think the problem is that it's a small, relatively small audience. It's the province of Quebec and a few outside subscriptions. Yes?
If you support the tax on film tickets to eventually support the Canadian film industry, do you also support the public lending right for books?
So, the question was, if I support a tax on film tickets to support the film industry, do I also support public library? I think the question is the same sort of thing that's been set up in countries like Germany, and that writers are trying to set up here, that every time you take a book from the library, 5 cents goes to the author. I certainly do. Yes?
Maybe you mentioned one more question.
Just one.
Oh, I love that question. Well, quite a few. We've had as many as 4 men on the staff of Chatelaine. I've got nothing against men at all. Jack Batten, Alan Edmonds, a lot of Pierre Burton, quite a lot of men have written for us. What I'd like to point out, though, is that In spite of the fact that women's magazines in North America have been very well established for a long time, they've mostly been run by men. And right now, I think there are only about four women's magazines with women's editors. Women's Day, Cosmo, Ms., Ladies Home Journal. That's about it, and Chatelaine. Rest are all run by men.
Well, I think, ladies and gentlemen, that we have more than exhausted the patience of our speaker. She'll carry on, I suppose, if she must, but I really think we should give her a rest.
Thank you.
I should comment that it's Barbara Frum who's to blame for all these stacked juries of women we have these days in British Columbia. I don't say I'm complaining about them, but I would like Barbara Frum to explain to me whether I call her a forelady, a foreperson, or a Madam Foreman. But before I call upon Mabel Colbeck to thank our speaker tonight, I would like to emphasize the commercial I have up here, and also next week's speaker, have that right, have we? Mr. Justice Morrow from Alberta was formerly the judge of the Northwest Territories, and I think you perhaps have heard of him before, but he had a most exciting life for 10 or 11 years traveling through the North Country. He doesn't say he was doing it, but I think he was rewriting a good deal of the law of the North Country. Certainly Ottawa thought he was and didn't agree with him. So I hope you will come again next week. Dr. Colbeck?
Well, it's my very pleasant task indeed to say thank you to our speaker for a most enlivening and timely and informative address. But chiefly, I think, I would like to thank her for upholding the great tradition of journalism. A tradition, I think, that Addison and Steele upheld so nobly once when they said that all writing should have a worthy purpose. I think today, when you open your Chatelaine at the editorial page, you'll find that not only has the mantle of the great journalist fallen on Doris Anderson, but she has embellished it and given luster to this tradition. Her editorials are full of facts we ought to have, but often don't. Nor would we always find them particularly palatable if we did have them. But she's presented them to us with pungency and grace. In other words, to quote these great journalists, Addison and Steele, she tempers wit with morality and enlivens morality with wit. We thank you.
Well, that's the meeting for this evening, ladies and gentlemen. I believe there is some coffee in the foyer if you'll please join us.